My name is Eric Davis. I'm a sleep faculty member at the University of Virginia, and I've been asked by our GME office and the Department of Medicine residency team to give an updated talk on some strategies to improve our overall sleep and health and how sleep is related to medical training. I've given many versions of this talk in the past, and this is the first time I've been asked to give a podcast, so bear with me as I work through this. As an overview of the outline, I want to talk a little bit about how common sleep deprivation is overall, as well as in the medical community. Address some ways that sleep deprivation can negatively impact health and safety of yourself and patients. And then go through a few strategies to help improve overall sleep health and to work through periods of sleep deprivation. And to start this off, I'm going to just share a personal anecdote to highlight the urgency and the importance of this topic. When I was an intern, I guess almost 20 years ago, I had on my list of to-do items one particular post-call day that I needed to do a thoracentesis on a patient. And I consented the patient. We set up to do the procedure, and I got started. And things seemed to be going okay. Then the patient started coughing a bit and said to me, "You know, I hope things are going well back there. I just wanted to ask why you decided to do the right side instead of the left side, because you had consented me to do the other side." And this moment for me was really impactful at that moment, at that time in my early training, but also sticks with me here and now, and sleep deprivation played a major role in how that went down. And I'll come back to the outcome of that case at the end of this session as a way of trying to keep you all engaged and interested. So kicking things off with the topic of sleep deprivation and how common is it? So you look at general population of adults in the US, about a third of adults are getting less than 7 hours of sleep a night. And that means a third of us are chronically sleep deprived. And if you add presence of medical conditions such as insomnia, sleep apnea, and other sleep conditions, a lot of patients out there are either not getting enough sleep or not getting good enough quality sleep. When it comes to residents and fellows, the numbers are even worse. And a recent study indicated that about the average resident gets 6.2 hours of sleep per night. And that's here and now, even after there's been a number of updates to improve overall work hours over the last 20 years. As you know, many changes went into effect after a famous case called the Libby Zion case, in which there was a medical decision error that was attributed to sleep deprivation in New York. And this was the beginning of the 80 work hour week. And there's been a number of revisions in the duty hours of the subsequent 20 years to the current learning and work environment that you're familiar with. So sleep deprivation is very common and it's serious. And there are some strategies that have been put in place to try to mitigate that. So let's talk a little bit about some of the dangers and some of the issues that are of concern to us when it comes to sleep deprivation. So in particular, medical errors. So one of the studies that I like to cite when giving this talk is a study that was done back at the Brigham Women's Hospital 20 years ago, where they put together a traditional Q3 overnight schedule for interns in the ICU and compared that to this rotating schedule where nobody had a prolonged shift. So there were none of these overnight 30-hour shifts. And they looked at differences in medical errors between the original traditional schedule and this interventional schedule that requires shorter shifts. And what they found, as you can imagine, is that individuals on this intervention schedule made fewer serious medical errors, a significant reduction in medical errors. And these were most notably a reduction in prescribing medications for the wrong patient or the wrong dosing, but also there was a reduction in the amount of diagnostic anchoring or other diagnostic errors. This study also looked at sleepy driving, and there are a number of other studies that looked at sleeping driving for the residents who were working extended shifts. And I like to think about this trial that was published soon after the Brigham and Women's study, which looked at driving simulators in individuals who were post-call after a month of working a very busy, busy rotation. These individuals, after their long 30-hour shift, came in for a driving simulator test, and they were compared to some of their colleagues who had just finished a month of a very easy rotation and were not on call. And then they had a third group where individuals who were finishing a pretty easy month were then tested in a driving simulator using after having been given two vodka tonics. And what they found was that those who were post-call after a very busy month drove just as poorly as the individuals who were given two drinks and then tested on the driving simulator. And both of those groups, as you can imagine, did quite a bit worse than the individuals who were just driving after a pretty light month. And this suggested that driving post-call is just as dangerous as driving with alcohol in your system. From a real-life perspective, going back to actual patients and real-life scenarios, there was a survey that was done of 2,700 interns many years ago, and they looked at the chance of having a motor vehicle collision or near-miss incident after an extended work shift as compared to driving home from a regular work shift. And both crashes and near-miss incidents were much more commonly experienced after driving home from an extended shift. How about the impact of sleep deprivation on my overall well-being? This is also critically important. There are a number of trials out there that have looked at this topic. And I'm looking at a meta-analysis of 54 studies as I'm talking through this right now, looking at an overall prevalence of depression of about 28% in medical interns and residents and fellows. And interestingly, there was no significant difference between types of residency program. And if you looked at some of the risk factors for the development of depression, a related trial looked specifically at internal medicine residents at the beginning and at the end of their intern year and found that the risk of developing a diagnosis of depression or a high degree of burnout was significantly higher in those who had sleep deprivation during their internship year. And our own mental health clearly can suffer if we're not getting enough sleep. I want to move, the bulk of this session to think about some strategies to help. And I only gave a few examples as they pertain to, medication errors, diagnostic anchoring in the face of sleep deprivation, motor vehicle collisions, the impact of depression. These are all major, major issues and concerns that are worsened in the setting of sleep deprivation. So let's think a little bit about, what can we do to help address sleep deprivation either in real time or chronically. When I think about strategies, and as I've given this talk before, I do think it's important to really recognize that we all are at risk of having a sleep disorder. So if you are someone who snores and wakes up gasping, then you need to see a sleep specialist because you might very well have obstructive sleep apnea. And some individuals have real major shifts in their circadian rhythm, which can impact how much sleep you're able to get and how that impacts performance during the day. Others, although it's incredibly rare, people can develop narcolepsy. And there are some features such as cataplexy or sleep paralysis or sleep onset hallucinations that if these are things that you experience, it's probably worth seeing someone to evaluate you for that. Additionally, insomnia is common. Well over 10 to 15% of adults have chronic insomnia in this country, and there's a number of factors that can worsen insomnia. it can often be a symptom of other disorders. So if that's a driver of sleep deprivation, that needs to be addressed either with your primary care physician or a specialist. So that's the first thing I would recommend in terms of strategies to help with sleep. And then if you don't have a lot of risk factors or you're not concerned about that, then, you know, thinking about what are the goals for healthy sleep. Ideally, we all get 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night, and we maintain some regularity with the sleep and wake times. A number of trials have demonstrated that when residency programs shift more towards a night float system and away from a rotating overnight schedule, that helps to improve vigilance, performance, and mood in those individuals. So a lot of programs have moved towards night float systems. Interestingly, I was not very supportive of that transition when that was starting to happen 10 years ago, but maybe I was a little sleep deprived myself as I was just emerging from that type of a training environment. But definitely trying to maintain a regular schedule is helpful. We love to sleep in cold, dark, quiet places without a TV or smartphone. If you're not able to fall asleep within 20 minutes, get out of bed, do something boring, and, you know, try to avoid caffeine too close to bedtime. Other medications can certainly have impacts on your sleep quality, and alcohol in particular, although it can help people fall asleep quicker, often leads to more fragmented and disrupted sleep 3 to 5 hours later into the evening. So those are things to be mindful of. So those are some of the kind of long-term strategies to help improve your sleep. But what are some of the strategies to help you in the moment? And exercise, I'm going to start with, is something that I had learned improved my performance when I was a critical care fellow 15 years ago. And we would run our codes in the middle of the night for the hospital. And I found that if the code alarm went off, and I was sleeping because it was the middle of the night of a long shift, I found that if I just took 30 seconds to do some stretching exercises before heading off to join the code team, that improved my performance as the code leader. And my role was never to be the first one there and start CPR. It was more to just organize and provide some structured response. So that delay of 30 seconds led to a significant improvement in my performance. And I observed that in my own behavior. And there's actually some studies to support that. And one that I like to show when I give this talk is the study looking at a group of individuals who were given simulated night work. And the control group, they weren't even allowed to get up from their desk while they're doing this very boring work. They had structured bathroom breaks 3 times over the course of the 8-hour shift and could eat twice for very specific breaks of the time. And then the intervention group got to have the same degree of breaks, time to eat, but on top of that, they would get this hourly exercise. And the exercise involved some stretching, swinging of the arms, twisting of the torso, bending at the knees. And it was 3 minutes of exercise every hour. That's it. And what they demonstrated is that the group that was randomized to get hourly exercise had a significant improvement in overall performance. So even though they technically had 5% less time per hour to work, their performance was markedly better. Now, this performance tended to dip later in the shift as they were just kind of getting tired, but it still exceeded that of the control group. And that's kind of an in-the-moment mechanism in which, you know, exercise can help stimulate overall performance in the setting of being sleep deprived or awoken. But chronically, there's a number of trials that have looked at moderate intensity aerobic physical activity and its impact on overall sleep time, sleep efficiency, and depth of sleep. And there's a number of trials that it typically go through, but they've each demonstrated some impact on sleep regulation, whether it's impacting your core body temperature, impacting growth hormone, vagal tone, inflammatory markers, your circadian rhythm and melatonin secretion, or even having a positive impact on your mood, resulting in better sleep. A number of trials have shown that moderate regular physical activity is truly beneficial on improving your overall sleep. So something that has been an important part of my life to improve my sleep health and performance that I think has been really beneficial. There's a few trials that actually randomized individuals to daily exercise and compared them to their cohort that were not allowed to exercise for 3 weeks straight. And as you can imagine, the exercise group slept deeper and better. There's a trial that looked at how someone slept after a day in which they rode on an ergometer for 30 minutes versus were not able to do any physical activity, and even 30 minutes of exercise had a tremendous impact on many markers of their sleep quality. And many of you have probably experienced this yourselves. People often ask me, if I exercise too late, will that cause problems with my sleep because it heats my body up and that tends to be a deterrent for getting to sleep? And I generally just say, no, it doesn't matter. Exercise whenever you want to exercise, because any exercise is better than no exercise when it comes to getting good sleep. I recommend probably avoiding playing hockey late night. I used to play hockey games at 10 to 11 o'clock at night, and I would say I could not sleep very well after those nights. But in general, any exercise is good for sleep. Okay. Caffeine. So moving on from exercise to caffeine, how do we use caffeine to help us? And in fact, the ACGME says, hey, it is recommended. Think of it as a not as a food, but rather as a drug to be taken when one is most fatigued. And that's according to ACGME. And it is true that caffeine will help us not only be more alert, but can positively improve performance. Generally, the effect is 15 to 30 minutes with a half-life of 3 to 7 hours. Although we all know that we have variable responses to different types of caffeine, and how I respond is going to be different than how somebody else does. So know what works for you. A typical dose is up to 400 milligrams of caffeine, which is quite a lot. I mean, that is a large cup of coffee. So try to figure out what dose works best for you. It's good to avoid getting more than 800 milligrams of caffeine per day, just because of side effects and impact on your sleep. And do we have any clinical trials to justify that, in fact, caffeine does improve performance? Yes, one such trial is, again, going back to driving simulators. This particular trial took 12 subjects in various experimental conditions, either sleep deprived to 4.5 hours a night versus 7.5 hours a night. And then they were given intravenous placebo or intravenous caffeine, 300 milligrams. And they looked at various markers of their driving on the simulator. And for those who got enough sleep, 7.5, 8 hours of sleep a night, they really had minimal impact with the use of caffeine. So caffeine did not markedly improve their performance in driving because it was already excellent driving. And whereas the sleep-deprived group, they had an increase in lane drifting and speed deviation compared to those who got enough sleep. But when they got their intravenous caffeine, their driving improved back to how it was for the regular good sleepers. So it's kind of an interesting trial. And so we've kind of gone over exercise, we've gone over caffeine. I want to talk about naps. And I think this is the last fatigue or sleep mitigation strategy that I'm covering in today's session. So what about naps? I tell my patients all the time that naps are a good idea. We are supposed to nap. If you go down to the coffee cart 2 to 3 in the afternoon during the workday, you're going to see a long line because we're all fighting our biological drive to take a nap. And if we provide ourselves with enough time in the day to take a 15 to 20 minute nap, and some cultures that's how the workday is structured, I would strongly recommend exploring that. But let's think a little bit about how a nap has been shown to be helpful. These trials that I generally cite are a little confusing to describe without showing you the pictures. But in one trial, they restricted individuals' time for sleep at night to develop a bit of a sleep pressure. And then they had them take different size naps. They either had no nap, they had a short 5-minute nap, 10-minute, 20-minute, 30-minute. And their goal was to say, what's the perfect nap duration, right? And then they looked at how did you do after your nap? How did you feel in terms of your sleepiness after your nap over the course of the rest of the day? How quickly did you fall asleep in subsequent naps that day as a way of marking that you didn't really get restorative sleep? And believe it or not, the best nap duration in that study was between 10 and 20 minutes. Any longer than that, people woke up pretty grumpy, confused, and irritable, something called sleep inertia, and had a bit of a lag before they got feeling better. And any shorter than that, they just didn't get enough sleep. So what I tell my patients is set your clock for 20 minutes. And even if you think you didn't sleep, you probably did, and that's enough. So 20 minutes, that's really the sweet spot. Good to take your naps when your circadian rhythm needs it. And the best nap time is usually around 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Or if you're working nights and you're able to get coverage for your pager for a little bit, between 2 and 4 in the morning is a nice time to reboot. So take some short naps. And there's been some specific studies looking at naps in medical education. One that I'm citing looked at residents who worked in the emergency department, and these individuals were granted a 2-hour break in the afternoon during their shift with or without a nap period. And there were positive impacts on overall mood and affect in those who were randomized to get a nap. There were better markers of overall sleep for those who were given naps. Now, interestingly, in this one study that I could find on medical education and naps, they did not see a significant improvement in overall performance in those who are randomized to naps. So that's covering the talk for today. I kind of went through how common sleep deprivation is in general, as well as medical education. We talked about some negative impacts on sleep deprivation on health and safety of patients and of us. And then I provided some strategies to help. And coming back to my patient who I opened with, as a refresher, I was doing a thoracentesis. It was that time we worked Q4 overnight on my oncology rotation. And it was about 40 hours into my shift, probably exaggerating a little bit, but I just made an error, which I'm attributing at least in part to sleep deprivation. And fortunately, in his case, he had bilateral effusions, and I was able to drain quite a bit of fluid off the wrong lung. He was really understanding and frankly appreciative of the notion that I got some fluid out anyway. But this was a moment that I was able to escalate to our chief residents at the time and think a lot about how we need to protect ourselves when we're sleep deprived. And this was also before timeouts or before real routine supervision of procedures. And some of the steps that we took as a program over the subsequent few years were to improve that process. And it's not solely because of my own experience with that patient, but I know that that error drew a lot of attention to some of these factors. And like many other scenarios, improved overall care and attention to the importance of sleep. So, for those medical residents, interns, fellows out there listening to this, your sleep is so important to your health and to the health of your patients and to the community. We take it very seriously. Fill out those surveys honestly, because it's better to know about a problem if you're not getting enough sleep. Our insight is limited in terms of how sleep deprived we are. So, please help your colleagues out if you notice that they're acting differently or clearly showing signs of sleep deprivation, because by helping them, you're helping your patients and helping before something serious can happen. For the faculty listening, please, you know, look out for the residents and the fellows so that we can make sure that everyone's getting enough sleep, and look out for yourself. So thank you all for listening. Appreciate you taking the time on this very serious topic. That's all I have. Thanks.